Nate Silver of the New York Times 538 blog has a new book out titled The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't. In it, he cites a landmark study by psychologist Philip Tetlock, who evaluated a sample of political experts on their ability to predict events. Every month for a total of two decades, Tetlock asked each expert to predict the likelihood of possible future events, from Quebec seceding from Canada to the fall of the Soviet Union. The results, says Silver, were embarrassing. The experts performed barely any better than random chance, though, interestingly, they didn't all perform equally badly.
One class of people did a little bit better, and that's what he called foxes. Ironically, they're the people who are not looking for a perfect prediction. They're looking to take different types of information, consider different hypotheses, and acknowledge that the world is complicated. The hedgehogs, who are the counterpart to the foxes, tend to be big believers in a grand unified theory. So they see everything through the prism of, say, class conflict, or everything through the prism of, oh, media bias potentially, or they think they're right about everything pretty much through their theoretical conceptions of how things behave.
The people who are pundits on TV making political prognostications, I'm going to assume they're not foxes, they're hedgehogs.
So one other component of the study that Tetlock did is he looked at how many mainstream media appearances the people in his survey panel had done. And he found that the more often people did media, the worse their forecasts were. Because then they have incentives to say outlandish things. And I talk about the example of Dick Morris in March of this year, said he thought Donald Trump would run and be a very formidable candidate in the Republican primaries, who in 2008 said Barack Obama would win like Tennessee and West Virginia, who thought that Hurricane Katrina would help President Bush. You could almost create a hedge fund just betting against whatever he says, but he still remains in the kind of regular news rotation and people take him seriously.
There is no penalty in the world of television punditry for being wrong. There's a great incentive to be bold.
The classic media bias is rooting for the story. Certainly after the conventions, I think the press became very interested in the Romney is imploding story. But in the long run, people sell more papers and get more listeners and viewers if you have a close down-to-the-wire election. And so in 2008, on the McLaughlin Group, the long-running show where they have four reporters come on, or four pundits, I guess, depending on how flattering you want to be toward them. The weekend before the 2008 election, this was a time when Barack Obama led by 7 points in the national polls. He led in almost literally every single poll of every single swing state. The economy had collapsed. But three of the four panelists of the McLaughlin Group said it was too close to call. Monica Crowley actually said she thought McCain would win by half a point. The next week on the same show, she implied that Obama's win had been inevitable because the economy had collapsed, all the obvious things which she had neglected to consider like literally a week earlier. It's like the whole group has amnesia.
When you read 538 blog, you get like a weather forecast. There's a 90% chance of rain.
Sure.
Means that 90% of the time under identical conditions, it's going to rain. That's how you do it?
That's how we do it, because we're not pretending that we can make an exact forecast of an election. If you're in early October, there are a lot of contingencies that could move the polls, but we have some sense for what the relative probabilities are. So presidential debates, for example, have sometimes moved the polls by about 3 points. There have been cases where even on election day, there were late-breaking developments, like in 2000 when George W. Bush was revealed to have had a DUI arrest that moved the numbers. And there's ambiguity based on the fact that only about 10% of people now respond to surveys, even to the best, most thorough surveys. And so all pollsters are hopeful that the 10% of people that do answer the polls are representative of the 90% who don't, but who might vote in the actual election anyway. So there is some ambiguity, but we can use history to say how accurate have the polls been at different points in the campaign and give you the betting odds like a handicapper would.
In your book, you cite that more than 90% of all data collected in human history has been amassed in the last...
In the last 2 years.
Which you would think would enable us to crunch the numbers and be extraordinarily accurate in predicting all sorts of things, but...
Well, a lot of that data is like cat videos on YouTube or Justin Bieber testimonials sent via text message. So we certainly haven't produced 90% of all the useful information in the past 2 years. For example, we're at the point in the election now where you get maybe 20 or 30 polls every day between state polls and national polls. If you're a Romney supporter and you pick the three of those polls you like best based on random variance and anything else, you'll always be able to tell a happy story about what happened. If you're an Obama supporter, of course, you can do the same thing. So if people are going to cherry pick the evidence, when you give them more of a choice, then they can isolate themselves more from what an objective forecaster might say.
In the introduction to your book, you talk about two historical watersheds that changed our thinking about prognostication. One was the printing press.
Before the invention of the printing press in the 1400s, knowledge was really, really expensive. It literally cost the equivalent of $20,000 to copy a book manuscript. And then all of a sudden, with Gutenberg's invention, you could mass produce books. And you had, finally, the accumulation of knowledge. But you had 200 years of holy war first. The Protestant Reformation was directly tied to the printing press. People were going to disagree about their interpretations of the Bible or of other things. And now they had evidence to prove their point of view. And you had a very bloody couple of centuries before you finally saw progress made, but it took 200 years. Now we have a similar step change in information, which is caused by the internet. I'm 34, right? When I was growing up, you actually had to wait for the morning paper to come out to see the baseball box score. You know, it was kind of astounding now. But we haven't developed our protocols for how we use all that information. And I think it's just like after the printing press led to a lot of conflict and partisanship and mistakes for the time being.
Well, if your analogy is right, then maybe now that society is getting used to this growing amount of data, we're headed towards a new enlightenment?
Well, I'm not sure about that either. I mean, people think, oh, as information increases, you'll reach some singularity. I do think we have to also acknowledge that as cool as our computers and our technology might be, it's still humans who have to design them and implement them. If you input garbage into a model, it'll spit garbage out. We're going to make some mistakes at first, as we have. I mean, everything from the financial crisis to the earthquake in Japan were not predicted, or in the case of Japan, were predicted not to happen. The seismologists there thought you couldn't have an earthquake that large. But I do think as we get better at knowing where our technology can help us and where it might lead us astray, where you still need human judgment, and where you can kind of press the on switch and turn things over to the machines, then we'll begin to make progress. But the point of the book, I suppose, is the sooner that we admit that we have a problem, that we're not as good as prediction as we think we are, then we can move toward enlightenment one step at a time.
Nate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nate Silver writes the 538 blog for the New York Times and is author of The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't.